We will turn now to the first case of the day, case number 1, Freed versus Barack Obama, appeal number 10-1973. Mr. Sturgill.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lowell Sturgill. I'm here from the Department of Justice representing the federal defendants. Your Honors, the district court erred in holding that 36 U.S.C. 119, which calls upon the president to issue a National Day of Prayer proclamation, unconstitutional, and similarly erred in entering an injunction that bars the president from enforcing the statute. As our briefs explain, the plaintiffs lack standing to challenge either the statute or the president's enforcement of it. And even if they did have standing, the statute and the president's enforcement of the statute are consistent with the Establishment Clause because they merely recognize and regularize a practice that has traced its roots to the practices of the very first Congress, which drafted the Establishment Clause.
So let's spend a little time on this standing issue and the injury that plaintiffs allege. How could a plaintiff show injury other than how it's been done here? They allege, as you know, that they're atheists or non-believers. They don't believe in prayer. They learned about National Prayer Day through the news. How could a plaintiff show an injury under this statute?
Well, the plaintiffs agree, everyone agrees, and the district court, that the test is a plaintiff must show direct and unwelcome exposure to the government action they challenge. Now, clearly, prayer proclamations are unwelcome to the plaintiffs, but they haven't proved any kind of direct exposure. For example, in this court's cases, this court has said that if there's a Ten Commandments monument in a park, well, a plaintiff who goes through the park in the course of their normal activities and has to see the offensive to them Ten Commandments monument, they have standing because they have direct injury. But in a case, the Zielke case, with respect to these plaintiffs, if they don't actually walk through the park during the normal course of the activities, then they wouldn't have standing.
But see, this isn't a walk through the park kind of case. This is a National Prayer Day that's declared, and so I'm trying to get at, do you think there's anyone who would ever have standing to sue to challenge this statute?
Well, two responses. First of all, even if the answer were no, in Valley Forge, the Supreme Court said, and this is almost a quotation, the court said, even if there is no plaintiff withstanding to challenge government action under the Establishment Clause, that's not by itself a reason to find that there must be standing. So that's the first response. The second response is yes. I mean, there could be plaintiffs withstanding to challenge this. For example, if the president were to hold a press conference and he were to invite members of the public, and he would do this every year, the members of the public were to know that he was going to announce and proclaim the National Day of Prayer. If somebody was actually at the press conference and heard the president announce and proclaim the National Day of Prayer, that would be the kind of direct exposure that would provide Article III injury. But we have nothing like that here.
So if there was, say, just theoretically, a national day against Jewish people, let's say that was a day, do you think that would be sufficient? Would someone have standing to sue to challenge that?
If the president were to, for example, hold a press conference that announced that kind of a day, or if the president were to transmit to people in some sort of format directly that kind of proclamation, then sure, somebody would have standing to challenge it. But short of that, the mere fact that the statute exists doesn't give anybody standing. The Ninth Circuit just held that in two cases. One was the motto case. The national motto says, "In God We," the federal statute recognizing the motto, "In God We Trust." The plaintiffs said that we want to challenge that statute because it offends us, similar to the plaintiffs in this case. And the Ninth Circuit said the mere fact that you're aware that there's a federal statute out there does not give you standing to challenge it. In fact, the district court in this case said that no plaintiff has standing to challenge a statute merely by trolling through the statute books and finding things that they find offensive.
But this wasn't, as I understand the plaintiff's position, they really weren't trolling through to try to find it. You know what they've alleged, and what the district court found, that is, that they heard about it, they saw it, they knew it was on the Internet, they knew it was on the White House webpage, and then you mentioned this Valley Forge case. The court said that it was not retreating from its earlier holdings that standing can be predicated on non-economic injuries. How do you reconcile that with your position here that plaintiff's stigmatic injury isn't enough?
Well, Valley Forge held that stigmatic injury is not enough. In that case, the plaintiffs had awareness of the federal action they challenged, which was the giveaway of federal surplus military property to a religious college. The plaintiffs were aware of that, and they were aware of it through news reports. And the Supreme Court said the mere fact that you learned about this through the news is not sufficient to give you the kind of direct Article III injury that allows standing. And the reason is, I think, pretty clear. If mere awareness through a news report could give somebody standing, well, anybody in the country could have standing. In fact, anybody throughout the world could have standing. The district court said somehow, well, the plaintiffs would have to, the only way they could protect themselves would be to leave the country. Well, foreign press can report on presidential actions and proclamations, so even that wouldn't provide the kind of limit that the district court thought it would. And in fact, one of the interesting things about Valley Forge is there's a footnote in Valley Forge which mentioned that some of the plaintiffs in the case actually lived in Pennsylvania, and that was the state in which the federal military property that was being given away resided. So the notion, the sort of geographic limitation that the district court thought would help cabin its theory, wouldn't at all and doesn't comply with Valley Forge itself. But even backing up, if you look at the statute itself, look through the complaint. I looked through it again before this argument, and there's not a mention of the statute anywhere. The plaintiffs don't even say they're aware of the statute. So there's no allegation of injury with respect to the statute. What the plaintiffs say is, well, we're aware of the president's prayer proclamations implementing the statute because we've heard about it through news reports. Well, Valley Forge, again, is completely inconsistent with that idea that can create Article III standing. And then, Judge Williams, you also mentioned one of the plaintiffs, excuse me, I have a frog in my throat, did go on the White House website to confirm that the proclamation was made. Well, the district court itself correctly held that a plaintiff cannot manufacture their own Article III injury by coming to the harm. And hence the district court said, that's why the district court said the plaintiffs don't have standing to challenge the presidential proclamations generally, because the only way they found out about them was by coming to the harm, by seeking them out. And the law, again, is clear that Article III injury occurs only when somebody is exposed directly to the government action they challenge in the normal course of their activities, something they would normally be doing anyway.
Well, this Jill Dean said that she was distinctly aware of the National Prayer Day, and it was prompted by news accounts on the NDP prayer breakfast that was sponsored by the county sheriff in Wisconsin. And as you know, many states have adopted this prayer day, and there are many activities that are connected with the prayer day. And so just in the normal course, she said she learned about it.
Well, again, she learned about it through news reports, which we think under Valley Forge is not enough.
There's an issue that I look at, it, and that's the I sort of look for a coercive issue. Someone is subjected to something that they don't want to be subjected to while they're doing something else. And I guess I look at it as an assembly of some kind. They've assembled for a different purpose. We'll call it a secular purpose. And this is one of the things with the schools and other. I saw a headline this morning where some football player pointed at the sky because he made a touchdown. He had done that a lot, and the school has ordered him to stop that. I don't know who's being coerced there, but there seems to be, we've gotten so far now, almost anything seems to rally this up. But the person who's coerced is where it says the president shall issue each year. But the proclamation, it's sort of an optional thing, it seems. The proclamation itself where he issues that everybody should want to pray in no way. And I guess I'm looking for something coercive, something that forces someone to do something or hear something they not want to, other than the audience being the whole country. There a narrower audience here that they could focus on?
I don't think so. I think you make a good point in that the statute itself doesn't call upon anyone to pray. All it says is the president shall issue this proclamation, that people may choose to respond to it by praying, or or they may not. They can meditate, they can pray, they can do no response. You know, this statute's in a part of the U.S. Code that contains 30 or more other ceremonial requirements that the president issue a ceremonial proclamation: Mother's Day, Leif Erikson Day, Memorial Day, and, you know, that shows the ceremonial nature of what's going on and the non-coercive nature of the statute. So,
well, that's additional. In that regard, though, let's just take Memorial Day. Memorial Day to remember our fallen heroes from the war, whatever. Well, someone who doesn't believe in God or anything else but has an ancestor or somebody, a father, who was killed, would that person then have standing if they start praying at this service that they went to was just Memorial Day for a secular reason? It seems that at least the other side here says that's okay. You can be imposed upon if you're there for a purpose and you don't like what they're doing, because there is, it's a secular holiday, the Memorial Day. But it also involves a lot of prayer, for people praying for the fallen heroes. Would that person have standing? I'd perhaps ask the other side for that.
Well, I think if the government were sponsoring an assembly, or, for example, a presidential press conference in which a proclamation was being given, and then in the midst of the conference or the assembly, some government actor or state actor were to engage in religious activity, then somebody who was there and really just came to hear the pronouncement and didn't want to hear the prayer could challenge the government activity, because, again, they're directly exposed by being there to the unwanted religious activity.
But those challenges have failed because of the conjunctive secular purpose.
They can fail on the merits sometimes because...
Well, yeah, I guess standing is the issue here. But
right.
I'm looking ahead with it more about what the bottom line is here, because there has to be, when you talk about audience, as far as finding who's got standing, it's a person in the audience. In this case, seems only to be everyone. There is not a way to narrow this for at least the way it's presented, because nobody is assembled together doing something. They're not at a place where you do something else. It's just you're at home, you're on the street, you're driving your car.
That's right. The district court thought that it could erect a limiting principle by mentioning again that anybody who's outside the country wouldn't have the direct exposure. But again, that doesn't work because people outside the country, just like people inside the country, can find out about the pronouncement the proclamation through a news report. So I think that limit doesn't work.
Well, let's get, though, back to the point that Judge Mannion made. All these other laws and these holidays like Memorial Day, Thanksgiving Day, they have a secular purpose. There's a dual purpose. There may be prayer and thanksgiving, but there's a secular purpose to honor the soldiers. Here, there is no secular purpose, is there? You would agree that a national prayer day, if it was a federal holiday, would be unconstitutional. You can agree with that.
I'm sorry. What?
If the national day of prayer was a federal holiday, that would be unconstitutional, wouldn't it? The only focus on federal prayer day is prayer.
I'm not sure, because again, the secular purpose here is to reflect and regularize a practice, a benign practice that has been followed in the country since the beginning of the first Congress.
Now, doesn't that ignore, though, various founding fathers who were against endorsed prayer proclamations? I mean, the record is not as clear historically as you suggest.
Well, 2 points. First of all, in Marsh versus Chambers, the Supreme Court said what's of critical importance in the history of the country is what happened in the first Congress, because that was the Congress that drafted the Establishment Clause. And thus Marsh said, well, the first Congress itself approved and paid for chaplains to provide legislative prayers in that body.
But that was focused to that body, to the legislators, and it was the opening session of Congress. And I totally follow that, because that certainly is in the tradition. But to make that leap from opening a session of Congress to making it a national prayer day when there's no other secular purpose. That's what I'm having some trouble with, particularly when, you know, when you look at the legislative history, when you look at the statute, there's no mention of history or anything about reflecting on history. You know, if it were a day of reflection on history and values of the nation, that would focus on our tradition and our history without pushing prayer or endorsing prayer, wouldn't it?
Well, this court in the Sherman case upheld the Pledge of Allegiance as used in schools, even though it contains the words under God. And the words under God, the court held, are a reflection of the religious history of the country, the fact that our framers thought that our rights are given by, they're inalienable because they're given us by a creator. And the court didn't say that the pledge is unconstitutional because, you know, the pledge itself didn't reference specifically reference the religious history and the secular purpose of the words themselves. That's something the reasonable observer, Justice Connor has, and the Supreme Court has referred to as key in this context. The reasonable observer is charged with knowledge of all the relevant background and context and history. So in the pledge case, the reasonable observer is charged with knowing what the words under God mean. They're a term of art, and they refer to this larger background. And in the same kind of way, this statute is not unconstitutional merely because it didn't, in a more elaborate way, reference the history of what happened in the first Congress and has happened since of these presidential prayer proclamations.
When you look at the statute, it mentions God, prayer, and churches. It doesn't say anything about synagogues, mosques, or anything else. Isn't that a strong suggestion of an endorsement of Christianity?
No, because as we've mentioned in our briefs, and some of the amicus have done the same thing, the word church in the federal U.S. code is frequently, in fact most often, used as a shorthand for houses of worship. And you'll find this in any number of statutes. And for example, in 36 U.S.C. itself, and that part of the code that this statute has found, you'll find that in other statutes. So the reference to church is really just a code for houses of worship. The statute also mentions meditation. Well, non-religious people meditate. So the statute itself provides an option for people who want to commemorate the day, but do it in a non-religious way. And the fact that the statute mentions God, again, doesn't distinguish it from the pledge which this court has upheld, and it doesn't even distinguish it from the court cry that we heard this morning, the invocation, which is a prayer, God save the United States and this honorable court. Hear that every morning before you start your proceedings, and that has the word God in it, and it doesn't explain at more length why that's what the secular purposes were.
Well, some of those are discarded as rote repetition and ceremonial deism and that sort of thing.
Right.
Obviously, since I was in the Pledge of Allegiance class, I look at things a little differently, but that's my personal perception, which I guess is what I'm looking at here. When you have a national day of prayer, it would seem that without a secular purpose. You mentioned a secular purpose, and there's some rationalization. Obviously, there are lots of times we find that prayer, like in prison, where chaplains change somebody, where there is definitely a secular purpose. A year ago, we had the speaker at our circuit conference. It was a priest who lately became a priest, but a former dean of a law school, who talked about breaking up a gang fight, war, because this person who could do it came to him and he was prayerful, and for that reason. And that's certainly a secular purpose, at least not a secular result. Does it have to have a secular purpose if something doesn't coerce somebody? I keep coming back to coercion. That's why when you're talking about the whole country, it has to be offended, I guess, or somebody in it.
Justice Kennedy.
Let me just add to that, particularly since it's the president that's making the proclamation, which is, you know, the position of the president in that office, I think, carries more weight.
Maybe I could try to get both of those. With respect to coercion, I think Justice Kennedy has taken the position that every Establishment Clause plaintiff should have to prove some form of coercion. And I think the case is the Supreme Court hasn't gone that far yet. It still does require a secular purpose, but he has articulated the argument that you've laid out. I just think the court hasn't accepted that yet. And with respect to the fact that this is the president, again, the biggest oddity in the case, I think, is that the district court allowed and said the president is perfectly fine for the president to issue prayer proclamations. In fact, even if the statute is struck down under the court's opinion, the president can come back next year and issue another day of prayer proclamation. Again, so I don't think that the case is even redressable. But
one of your suggestions is that plaintiffs can avoid National Prayer Day by not listening to the radio or watching TV. But doesn't that place an onus on the citizens to avoid religious messages? I mean, shouldn't the burden really be on the government not to produce the messages in the first place?
I'm surprised that we said that. Maybe I'm hoping that's one of the amicus, because I don't think that's something we wouldn't want anybody to have to not watch TV. I like TV myself. And again, I think the point there is, you know, if they are exposed through TV or the media or whatever else they're doing, that's not enough under Valley Forge, because it's just sort of very generalist, kind of very generalized, non-immediate, non-direct exposure that doesn't count for the purposes of these tests. So we're not saying they don't have to watch TV. I mean, what they're saying is they have to leave the country. And we just think that's really far-fetched and shows the lack of limits to the district court's principle and why that it just can't possibly be correct.
I'll keep you another moment, because going back to what Judge Williams asked in the first place, and you answered by saying, you know, there may be some things where people don't have standing. This is what I guess I would be targeting. And she asked the question, who can challenge this? Who has standing to stop the president from carrying out it was a mandate from Congress that all 50 states seem to follow, local people get onto and in public forums. Who has standing to stop it? Would it be a local person? I'm saying just for that purpose, without being there for some secular purpose. This is just, we're gathering to pray. And it is a government person doing that, or maybe in a government place. I'm going to be careful with it. I'm trying to put it isolated, like we have this one. This one does not have an obvious secular purpose, even though you make an argument for one. And it doesn't seem to target anybody, other than just encouraging everybody in their own way to pray. Are you saying there's no standing here? They cannot have standing?
Well, no. Again, I think we tried to give you a couple scenarios where there could be standing.
Yeah, but somebody's in a press conference or something. You know, when you go to a press conference, you're there to write a story and make news. You can't go and object to something you went to for the purpose of getting news. If the news happens to be, that means to be part of it. I don't know about the press conference. I'm looking at it, you know, the general audience.
Well, again, it's got to be somebody who's directly exposed either to the statute, and that's the hardest case, the statute, because you can't troll through the books and the plaintiffs.
No, but your bottom line basically is nobody can sue under this statute standing alone. Just finding, knowing that there's a National Prayer Day, nobody can sue unless it's coupled with something else. I mean, that was your response to me. So that the bottom line is you're saying nobody can ever sue on this just on the statute alone. And so similarly, if it was a national day against Jewish people, nobody could sue if it was just the fact that the statute said the president should issue a proclamation that there's a national day against Jewish people.
Right. I think
that in itself, nobody would have standing to sue. No Jewish person who would be offended by it and said that they felt like they weren't a part of American society because the president was making such a declaration. I mean, any group. any group, there could be a proclamation against them, and they would not have standing. It would have to be someone had to act on that statute. Is that
right?
Your bottom line.
It has to be implemented in some way that directly, and the Supreme Court's decision in Allen versus Wright says the same thing. That was a race discrimination case, the greatest of all the compelling interests. And the court said the mere fact that somebody is aware that the government is discriminating, allegedly, and how it's dealing with racially discriminatory private schools, that mere awareness doesn't give them standing alone, the mere stigma of that.
Yeah, but that they've got to be that's a different kind of scenario in an educational context, because this is going out to the entire country. And at least in my mind, that's a different ball of wax than what we're dealing with here. I can understand the court's rationale in that case.
Well, again, I think the plaintiffs in that case lived in the very judicial school districts where the discrimination was allegedly occurring. So they're right there in the town where the racially discriminatory schools are that the government is supporting. I don't know how that is any different materially from what's going on here. In fact, this case seems to be less harm.
What if they're excluded from the school?
Well, then they have standing.
Yeah,
they have direct injury. But the mere fact that they're aware of it.
Those are kind of easy, though.
Right.
This is we don't have anybody that's targeted. Mm-hmm. You know, Jewish people, you know, targeting a Jewish religion. There's not a target here other than a general proclamation that encouraging people for whatever reason and however they do it to pray. And the only thing that seems to be happening as a result of this is that the only winner would be those who want no religion. And we had 11 amicus briefs. One of them, pretty much secular humanism, that's exactly what they want. And, you know, that's on one side. The other side wants to go back to ground zero, where start out back when the founders were there, and let's get this right. That's all it was, not going to establish a religion in some state. You can't do that. So we have wide parameters here. But
there are lots of circumstances where nobody has standing to challenge government action. The Supreme Court's decisions in the taxpayer standing cases, Richardson, Schlesinger, those cases, Valley Forge, this is not unique, even if that's where we end up. There are all sorts of things that the government does that can horribly offend people on lots of grounds. And unless they can show something specific, they've been denied a job or discriminated against, or they had to listen to something where they wanted to use the park and they couldn't. It's the general law that these people don't have standing.
All right, we've given you extra time. We've had lots of questions. Counsel, we'll give you extra time as well. Thank you. And I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Sturgill. Mr. Bolton.
Good morning. Government speech, and I think this is one of the things that is not disputed, government speech endorsing religion is prohibited by the Establishment Clause. Now, whether or not the National Day of Prayer law promotes religion is a subject of debate, but I don't believe it is a question between the parties that speech that is understood to promote and endorse religion is prohibited by the Establishment Clause. And that has not been understood by the Supreme Court to require the coercion issue that has been required in terms of the free exercise.
I was only looking at precedent that we have. Most of the time, these cases, when they come up, standing is the person who has been coerced. Whether that's a requirement or not, they generally are in a place they have to go, like in books, or they are in a school. You have to be there, that sort of thing, the Wallace case. So I think those are, I mentioned it, I realize that maybe the court hasn't gone that far, but that seems to be something that is a thread that runs all the way through these precedents.
I think the Supreme Court's recognition in numerous cases that the Establishment Clause does not require coercion was not a factually dependent. That is, the court has recognized that, unlike the free exercise, that the Establishment Clause does not require a sort of sticks and stones aspect to it. And as Judge Crabb recognized, as she went through some of the history of why is it, why do we care whether or not the country establishes, the government establishes religion or not. This was an experiment. This was something that was that the United States initiated as a way to prevent the history of sticks and stones sort of coercion that has been the history that the mixing in which Judge Grab described as a dangerous mixture of government and religion. Justice O'Connor has further, and the Supreme Court has, I think, regularly recognized that the sort of injury that is at issue with the Establishment Clause isn't just sort of a sticks and stones coercion issue. It is the fact that we identify some people as insiders and others as outsiders. And as Judge Crabb also noted, these are not insignificant. These are not trivial. And the fact of feeling excluded and the fact of inferiority. And these, by the way, are facts that the judge found to be the case and certainly the factual underpinnings of Judge Crabb's opinion in this case are not clearly erroneous. It is interesting that the advocates of a National Day of Prayer essentially engage in a sort of history as illusion, and that we generalize and say prayer is good generally, or prayer or religion is good generally, and as long as we don't identify particular sects, that it's okay. But the fact of the matter is that the Establishment Clause protects not just individual religious groups from discrimination, but, and I think this is also a matter of undisputed law at this point in time, the Establishment Clause protects non-believers, infidels, the Supreme Court has said, non-believers, atheists, every bit as much as Jews and Muslims and Catholics and Lutherans and Protestants.
All right.
I represent a minority.
Let me just stop for a minute because I want to get back to the standing question, because you've basically made that argument in your briefs that you're giving us now. It's a good summary. But in terms of the injury that you're alleging, did any of the plaintiffs have to alter their behavior in any way?
I do not believe that the... Are you asking, do they need to?
Yes,
as a matter of,
and exactly define your injury. I know what Judge Crabb said, and I...
The law, including not just from the Supreme Court, but the Seventh Circuit, has recognized that it is not necessary that there be some altered behavior or coerced exposure.
So here we don't have any altered behavior. We don't have any coercion. You'd agree with that? Because the statute does say may. It says the president shall issue the proclamation, issue the proclamation of the National Prayer Day, but it's a may in the specific language, you know, so it's not mandatory that
That's
people
right.
pray.
But but this goes back to what Judge Mannion is getting at, and that there's no coercive aspect to it. But the fact of the matter is that government speech matters. And the premise of the advocates of the National Day of Prayer is that government speech doesn't matter. Government speech that is mandated by Congress and then implemented by the president. We are essentially told that this is simply a generalized grievance and that no one's forced to do anything. But that isn't required by the Establishment Clause. It is the reaction to the speech that is the recognized injury.
A further question on standing. You're not asserting here taxpayer standing.
We are not asserting taxpayer standing. But to go back to some of the early argument, though, the Supreme Court has recognized that standing and the rules for standing can vary depending upon the type of case involved. If we were arguing taxpayer standing, the Supreme Court obviously has required the nexus between your taxpayer standing and the complaint. But the fact of the matter, and in other distributive or regulatory actions, if you're challenging some sort of regulatory action, then being subject to the regulation is important. But with government speech, the critical question is, who is the audience? And in the case of local displays, a test that focuses upon a pedestrian or pass-by concept, as the judge recognized, makes sense because the creche and the nativity scene at the courthouse, the audience for that is really no broader than the pass-by or pedestrian aspect of it. But to say then that the higher we go in the level of government, that there has to be that sort of pass-by aspect to it, it becomes almost ironic, because then the Establishment Clause basically only becomes enforceable at the lowest levels in which a challenge is made, at the local pass-by level. But to the extent that we go higher, and remember, the Establishment Clause begins with the language, Congress shall not do establish religion. And here we've got a law that is precipitated by Congress. But we are told that this is simply a sort of generalized grievance, that if you don't like it, that if Congress and then the president implements it, if you don't like it and there's no coercion, and you don't actually hear the president speak the words, then no one can challenge it. Well, first of all, in
terms... Let me get back for a minute. Let me ask you hypothetically, again, back to this question of standing. Would a plaintiff who hated trees be injured by a statute created that was called the National Save the Trees Day, that the president had to issue a proclamation and create a National Save the Trees Day? Could a plaintiff have standing in that situation?
You know, and I apologize. A national what?
Save the Trees Day.
Save the Trees Day.
Yes.
Well, you know, I smile because one of the questions that was asked of one of the principals of the Freedom from Religion Foundation in deposition was whether or not she was offended by a variety of other sorts of government speech. And her response was, those aren't unconstitutional, and I'm busy enough dealing with just the unconstitutional ones. So the question of a national Save the Trees Day, if the Constitution had a provision that said...
And because you had to have plaintiffs who hate trees, you know.
Yeah. then I think if you had a constitutional provision that said Congress shall you know, establish no law respecting trees, then I think that the standing principle would be the same, to the extent that... to the extent that, again, we're talking about government speech, and so to the extent that the speech is directed at a particular audience, the members of that audience would have standing. And that's why it isn't the case. One of the problems that sort of lurks under this case is that, as it was recognized, this case might be easier for some people if the law established a particular faith as, you know, proclaimed a particular faith. Because we have been taught to be solicitous of one religious belief over another. But I represent, in a sense, a minority, I'm told, and that is the group of people that are non-believers, and they are as much within the ambit of the protection of the Establishment Clause as if they were Jews or Lutherans or Muslims. And what's going on here, in a sense, is that we're going to tolerate government speech at the highest levels of government directed at all Americans, but as long as it is only excluding and only speaks favorably of all religions and seemingly only excludes non-believers, that's okay. It's not okay.
Well, the statute doesn't compel citizens to pray or to do anything, right? It doesn't compel them to do anything. It just says that people may pray and meditate, not that they must do anything on that day. But how severe is the harm when the statute doesn't compel anyone to pray?
But again, that goes back to the compel coercion. It is not a function of compulsion or coercion, but even it, you know,
Well, and let me go further on that, because we recently, in this Sherman versus Koch case, held that an Illinois statute with a prayer option was constitutional. Now, this mentions prayer and meditation. How do you distinguish that case?
Well, number one, you're speaking of the Van Zandt case, the meditation, the legislative.
Right. The Sherman case where the prayer option. Right.
Right. Well, number one, Van Zandt specifically also recognized that you were talking about a prayer room, or you know, a room for prayer and meditation that was essentially.
No, this is different. This is a school case.
We were both on the panel.
This is where there's a moment of silence.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
you're talking about the Sherman case.
Yeah.
Okay.
It happens to be the same Sherman.
Right.
The challenge that pledge of allegiance.
With a moment of silence, and again, this is important because, as the Supreme Court has recognized, to the extent that a moment of silence is really intended and perceived as a backdoor way to promote prayer, it's not okay. But if in fact it is truly just a moment of meditation, and there is no intent to promote prayer, then it has been held to be acceptable.
It allows prayer, but there's an alternative. I mean, that's why it's the closer question. The Wallace case, of course, it was proclaimed in the legislature when they passed it. They wanted to get prayer back in schools, and that was obviously a red flag, and the Supreme Court so identified it that way. But I think what we're looking at here, and again on this standing issue, is what is the you're basically saying it is just per se unconstitutional, period. It's there, therefore it is unconstitutional. Don't have to, and if somebody can just stand up and say that, that's it.
The notion that, first of all, standing has never been defined in terms of, you know, top 10, or that you have to have a certain cutoff, and beyond that you can't. There are certain types of injuries that have broader audiences than broader injury. For instance, very recently, this court addressed the question of the replacement for Senator Obama when he was in terms of his senatorial position, and certainly in that situation, the argument was made there that there was no standing, and the conclusion was that. In that particular case, basically, the Constitution prescribed a certain replacement procedure, and any electors, any voters, would have standing to challenge if they thought it was being done improperly. With respect to the Establishment Clause, at the highest levels of government, to the extent if the Congress passed a law without any compulsion, but simply stating that a particular religion is to be the national religion, and that the president should proclaim that is government speech. Everyone is an audience for that. And in fact, for instance, with the National Day of Prayer, whether I pass by it or not, something happens. There is a day each year that is designated, that is different than every year, that is demarcated and given the credibility of the government, that it's different. The National Day of Prayer is different in terms of its exhortations and what it is promoting. And that is true, quite frankly, whether I'm outside walking past the Capitol and I see a National Day of Prayer celebration, or whether I'm at home. The effect in terms of making me feel like an insider or an outsider is the same. Whether it is the fact that I have been exposed to that speech and government speech, it is not in today's day and age to conclude that government speech has to be delivered directly between you and me. And this and that is what they say the only form of standing would be if we had this type of contact, that this was the only type of direct contact to the National Day of Prayer proclamations that would support standing. That is simply not realistic.
Well, let me ask you, is the injury limited to National Prayer Day itself? Is it suffered on any other day?
Would it be?
Would the injury be limited to National Prayer Day itself? Is it suffered on any other day?
In respect to the law that is being challenged?
Yes.
I think it is defined in terms of the day that is being designated.
That's one I should have asked. What is the collateral effect of this? What in Vietnam they used to call it collateral damage. When you target one thing, but it spreads out and hits other thing. Is there collateral impact here? Once, if this is to say no more day of prayer, how does it affect these other proclamations, even though they may be attached to a secular holiday?
Well, and this goes back to when I referred to history as illusion. The National Day of Prayer is perceived. It is perceived. That's a fact that is not clearly erroneous, as found by the judge. It is perceived as a day in which the government is supporting and promoting religion. And the sort of collateral issue that you're talking about is that as a result, there is almost a national celebration of prayer on the National Day of Prayer, as to which the law mandating the president to designate a National Day of Prayer every first Thursday in May, the government, the Congress is the cat's paw in terms of this collateral effect that you're talking about. But I think, and that distinguishes, by the way, the National Day of Prayer on its facts in terms of its actual history, the real history for this, and its effect, which distinguishes it from the type of practices that the advocates indicate.
This isn't a national holiday. It doesn't seem to have widespread publicity other than the occasional news stories, as some of the plaintiffs allege. How should that play into our analysis?
Well, and this goes back to its history. The history of the National Day of Prayer was to establish this particular day in which the credibility of the government would be lent to a particular day, and the history was that it was orchestrated and organized and promoted and lobbied and adopted. The first National Day of Prayer legislation was introduced by Absalom Robertson, Pat Robertson's father, after a six-week crusade advocating it by Billy Graham. The history of that is now being utilized for its intended purpose, and that is that's why I refer to it as, in a sense, the cat's paw. People who wanted to have an easier opportunity to promote religion concluded that it would be easier, number one, if you had the endorsement and support of the government, and number two, it would be a lot easier if we knew when it was going to be, and that's why they went back to the well and changed it to have it be a particular day. The National Day of Prayer, the history and its effect is different than the examples that the government refers to, and that's why I refer to their history as illusion, because they refer to other instances that do not have the same historical back pedigree and the effect. In a sense, the National Day of Prayer, and Judge Crabb went to great lengths to indicate that that by saying that the government should not promote and endorse religion with its own speech is not to say that that people who want to pray and feel strongly about religion, that they should do that. The problem here is that, in a sense, the advocates for the National Day of Prayer need to have, they're seeking to rely on the credibility of the government to further their own end. And in a sense, what's happening here is that the government is being used in lieu of them having faith in their own message. People who strongly and sincerely believe in religion can do that, but they need to have the faith of their own convictions to do that without the credibility and support of the government.
Well, taking that argument that you're making, let me ask you this. Do you think you could sue to enjoin the president from having a prayer breakfast, which the same argument could be made that this was done to further the interests of the individuals who were at the prayer breakfast or to further their religion or...
Well, you know, and again, as the Supreme Court has also, and you, as you judges understand, all of these cases end up being very factually specific. With respect, for instance, to a prayer breakfast, one question that is different than with a national day of prayer is, who would be the audience that would sue with respect to a national day of prayer? Because there you do not have a proclamation, and so there the more localized aspects would be relevant. So, how was it? You know, what were the circumstances and what exactly was being done? It's hard to answer that question in the abstract, but I do think that one of the questions, the immediate question, would everybody have standing to challenge a national prayer breakfast if, in fact, it wasn't done in the same form of some sort of proclamation of a national day? I think the standing issues would be different there. They would be more like the display type cases where the audience is by definition more restricted than it is with a national day of prayer. The national day of prayer is government speech that is not irrelevant.
We keep coming back to that audience. And that was sort of the foundation of the audience for this is everybody. You mentioned something that what if there is in reaction to this? Because as I understand it, all 50 governors at some point have announced it. Day of prayer that many local people celebrate it or whatever they do. You said something, if someone wanted to go over to the state house or the county city building or something and encountered a rally for the day of prayer, suddenly they have an impact and maybe they can't go in or they feel very left out and all that kind of thing. But see, I'm getting back to the same coercive or reaction or impact or whatever we want to call it.
But, Judge,
then they'd have standing.
I agree. I don't disagree that they'd be standing there. But I don't believe that is the defining limit of standing when you're dealing with the congressional establishment of religion. But again, it goes back to, and I know the courts like to have defining limits and coercion. Is at least is more defining in a sense, but we're dealing with government speech, and the aspect of speech is that speech isn't necessarily coercive, but it can have the effects of, as Justice O'Connor has noted, the effects of defining insiders and outsiders, which then ends up having very direct effects on other issues relating to the distribution of benefits and regulations and whatnot. I don't even know what your religion is, Your Honor, or if you have a religion, but if we began court every day, and there was a federal law that required that every court proceeding begin with a crier falling out in some way, being critical of your religion, there may not be any coercion on you, but the effect, but there would be an effect there. And again, it goes back to people, and I know, and I grew up, I'm in Madison. People accuse people in Madison of being too hypersensitive. But the fact of the matter is that words have effects.
Let me ask you just a question with respect to this injunction. If we find the statute unconstitutional, is there any reason a declaratory judgment wouldn't be sufficient, just declaring the statute unconstitutional?
As opposed to an injunction?
Right.
Against the press secretary, the president?
Mm-hmm.
In all honesty, I believe that the effect would be the same. As the Supreme Court has also recognized when it is noted that, you know, this issue comes up on occasion where you've got some sort of regulatory statute and you can't directly enjoin the president, so you enter the injunction against the next lowest guy who's implementing it. And the argument has been, well, but that doesn't stop the president. And the Supreme Court has said, we are not going to assume that the president will ignore that type of declaration. So I'll be honest, I don't know that a declaratory judgment would be insufficient as compared to an injunction, because I do believe that if the court concludes that it's unconstitutional, I do believe that the president will respect the court's opinion.
All right. Anything else, Dan?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, judges.
And I said, Mr. Sturgill, I'd give you 2 minutes.
I wanted to clarify an answer to the question the court had about the hypothetical of the National Jewish Day. One critical difference between that and this statute is that that statute would be clearly sect-specific on its face. And it is possible that the Supreme Court might view that kind of a statute as striking so directly at the heart of the historical current concerns of the Establishment Clause, they might allow standing. A similar question just came up in the Supreme Court Arizona school financing case, which I don't think is cited in the briefs. And I know that the acting Solicitor General made the same point that I'm now making, that this might be different if the statute was sex-specific. And I'd be happy to provide you with a cite to the case. So I wanted to amend my answer in that regard. And you might actually, it would be very interesting to see what the Supreme Court says about standing in that case. It raises similar issues. Second, the notion that basically it matters that this is happening at the highest level of government and that this is, you know, this intended audience notion, there's no case that ever has said that that makes a difference. And in fact, the cases run the other way. The Hine case from the Supreme Court, the taxpayer standing case, plaintiff's allegations were that the president was out there at conferences and generally saying that faith-based institutions are great and should be promoted just because they're faith-based. And the Supreme Court said there was no standing in that case. So the cases, again, run the other way. And then there's no support for it at all. And now I guess I have a minute left, but that's really all I have.
All right. So. Thank you. Thank you, counsel, both for your fine arguments. We'll take the case under advisement.